This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by Bluehost. It's now easier and cheaper than ever before to start your own blog or website. For just $6.95 per month, you get unlimited hosting, one-click installation of a WordPress blog, a .com domain name, and so much more. Go to sqpn.com/bluehost for more information. And by the Amazon store. Click on the link on our website, thehobbit.sqpn.com, before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show.
SQPN.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Hello and welcome back to a new episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit, the show that is entirely dedicated to the two movies in production currently and almost going into post-production. Can't be long now. Some actors have now wrapped up their final filming, and it seems like the whole production is moving along quite on schedule. Joining me today, Dave Kale. Hey, Dave, how are you?
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you, too. I hope you had a restful weekend.
I did for the most part. Still, I have a looming big decision to make, which has been causing me some stress. But apart from that, it was very, very relaxing and enjoyable. Had some good food.
Yeah. Fasting is over. We can finally live like hobbits again.
Thank God.
It's been 40 long, long days. Yeah, that's the problem of doing a show about the Hobbit. You become a bit of a hobbit yourself.
Incompatible with fasting.
Yeah, it's almost like for 40 days you're living on just lambas. How do you pronounce that, actually? Is it lambas? Lambas?
Lambas, I don't
lambas.
Know. I
think that's that elven stuff.
you're right. And you have the same sort of take that the Frodo and Sam do, which is, you know, it sustains you and keeps you going. But boy, there's just some days when you really want to just sit down with a nice big feast.
Exactly. Well, fortunately for us, it's Easter, so we can. Hey, we have a fantastic Easter week because of all the news about The Hobbit. I can't believe how much is on our to-do list for today. So let's waste no more time and let's get going.
Get down. Confound it all, Samwise Gamgee! Have you been eavesdropping?
I ain't been dropping no eaves, sir, honest.
What did you hear? Speak!
Nothing important. Please, Mr. Gandalf, sir, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me in anything unnatural.
Now, just a small tidbit of news to start off with. It's the Hobbit t-shirt. We talked about it in our last episode, and apparently it's now available, for real.
Yes, there's a... If you go to the WB... online store, wbshop.com, you can find the Hobbit shirt.
And they look amazing. It just as you speculated, it has the famous image. I'm not sure if this is a painting or a photo or a photo that they kind of reworked in Photoshop, but it's a beautiful picture of Bilbo leaving Bag End and looking out over the Shire. And it's there's this golden glow. It looks beautiful. And they have Hobbit shirts in various sizes. I see four pictures, and the one on the left looks like it's made for a hobbit because it looks tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And then
they've got a youth t-shirt, women's relaxed fit t-shirt, adult t-shirt, women's fitted t-shirt. I don't know why they can't make men five different t-shirts too, but oh well.
I'm pretty sure that they must be available too, but... relaxed fit, is that a euphemism for, let's say, people who had a little bit too much of Easter food?
I think maybe they should refer to it as Hobbit fit. I don't know.
They're about $25 per t-shirt, which is not cheap, but it's a full color t-shirt. So it's a black t-shirt with a full color picture on it. And of course, you know, as a true fan, can you really do without it? I don't know. But that was.
I don't think I'm gonna order one because honestly, every time I buy a T-shirt that has a huge logo or graphic on it, I later find myself thinking like I find myself not wanting to wear it very much. So I'm gonna hold off and get one that's a little more understated.
It's so obvious. You only dare to wear it when you're at Tolkien parties and.
Yes.
Where everybody has one instead of in your regular, you know, the Starbucks or
are you a Hobbit fan or are you with Star Trek?
Anyway, hey, but let's go to the big news because, well, as I mentioned before, some actors have already wrapped up all their scenes and one of which is Stephen Fry. So what did he tell us?
Well, he as he so frequently does, made himself known via Twitter. There was a post from what day was this? Open link. Quick, open.
Sometime around Easter, probably.
Yeah, it was right around Easter. Let's see, April 10th, mm-hmm. which I guess was 2 days ago, Tuesday.
Yeah.
At 5:19 p.m., he tweeted, "Phew, got all emotional after shooting my final scene on The Hobbit, preparing for home over the weekend." And people are like, "That's huge!" It's kind of interesting and exciting. They've wrapped up all the scenes requiring the Master of Lake Town.
Which kind of ties into what we already saw in the production video where Peter Jackson was on the set of Lake Town and was telling us, you know, I can't show you anything of this, but this is what we're currently doing. And so it seems like they're doing most of the Lake Town stuff right now, and then they'll probably move to something else. Something that I thought of was that potentially the set is really big because after all it's a whole town and most of it is built inside, you know, it's the set is not out in the open, and so probably for space reasons alone they will probably have to tear it down, just as probably they did with the Rivendell set, because it just mm-hmm. takes a lot of space, and I've never been to the studios in Wellington, but I can imagine that they just need that space for other sets. And that they will just try to do as much as possible on the big set and then tear it down and probably just use the set pieces for smaller pickup shoots later on. But they won't rebuild the entire set.
And then
set.
2 or 3 years from now, they'll put the whole thing back up and turn it into a tourist attraction.
They should, you know. And if they don't, well, we should start a petition so that they do.
Yeah.
I want to
reconstruct all of Middle Earth in New Zealand.
I bet you that would be lucrative. Let's hope that Warner will follow Disney's example and cash in on this thing, or what they did with Harry Potter. After all, that's a Warner property, and they did the Harry Potter, the wonderful, what is it, the Wondrous World of Harry Potter in
The Wizarding World.
The Wizarding World, which is awesome, which is very, very cool. Now that wasn't built with set pieces, but it was based for the big part on the set designs that were made for the movies. Mm-hmm. And they've got another attraction open in London, in the London studios now, where you can visit actually. And they did use set pieces for that tour. So it's a tour of the Harry Potter sets. I think it's actually marketed like that you can actually, you can see the sets, you can see the big hall, you know, and all those iconic set pieces for yourself.
And they're going to open another one in L.A. I don't know if you'd heard that, too.
Yeah, indeed. Gives me another reason to come over to the United States soon. So who knows? If that works financially, I bet you that they'll consider doing the same for The Hobbit. And we'll finally get to see the entire set with our own eyes. But so he has wrapped up his Lake Town scenes. While I was reading this article that you sent me, I noticed a video on the left of the article, and it said it was an interview with Stephen Fry. Now, the backdrop of that interview, of the video, was I think it's a promotional poster for Sherlock Holmes. And so I figured, oh, that's probably an interview about another movie that he shot or that he was involved in. But, you know, just for just to be sure, I clicked on it, and lo and behold, the entire interview is about his role in The Hobbit, and you will not... Now, you haven't seen this video yet, Dave, but...
No, and I can't believe it, because it looks like it's actually from quite a while ago, but...
You won't believe how much he tells us about his role, and even about what he looks like, and about Lake Town, and what Lake Town looks like, and about the overall atmosphere. I mean, I'm just going to play it, and then we'll speculate about it, and we'll talk about it. But it is quite stunning. By the way, disclaimer, I'm not sure if the entire interview, I've not listened to the entire video yet. Not sure if everything is safe for work, probably, but just so you know, the title of the video is Stephen Fry, and then quotation marks, I ate testicles for The Hobbit. Just so you know. Here's Stephen Fry. Let me see. I don't have any audio. Might want to... Why don't I get any audio on this thing? Let me see. It should do audio. I see him talking. I see him moving his lips. But I don't have any audio here. Oh, I know what could be happening. This might be a part of... I've got a new computer to stream the show live on live.sqpn.com. And sometimes there's something wrong with the sound card. And so every once in a while, things just don't work. So I'm going to play that on the other computer, but why don't you tell us in the meantime about the next story on our to-do list, Dave?
Sure thing. we got a sneak peek of the set yet again.
Like a spy photo?
Yeah, sort of. My understanding is that there was a some kind of fire alarm type thing where the fire service, you know, firefighters and whatnot responded to it, which meant that they had to open up the gate to the set. And a photographer from the Dominion Post, one of the New Zealand papers, was apparently, I guess, standing outside the gate stalking them. And so when the gate opened, they took a photo. And managed to get a shot of something on the set, and it's a pretty interesting photo. I'm not clear at all what. There's a big green screen backdrop, and there's kind of a sort of a broken down looking house. It's really interesting. I wonder if that could be whose house could that be? I'm gonna go out on a limb and guess maybe that could be Radagast the Brown's house.
Could very well be. Yes.
Because it's not, you know, that's certainly not a building from Lake Town. And the fact that they have the green screen backdrop makes me think that they're going to CG in a bunch of maybe, I don't know, forest or something. I don't think it's part of Dol Guldur. Dol Guldur is sort of a fortress and a dungeon, not a house. It doesn't look at all like Bjorn's house, and it looks very different from that other house we saw before that was speculated to be Bjorn's house or maybe Radagast the Brown's house at Haas Gobel. So it's not a Shire Hobbit building. It doesn't look like it would be part of Dale or Lake Town. So I think it's got to be Radagast the Brown's dwelling in Mirkwood.
Could be, but I'm thinking that this could also be part of Lake Town.
You're right. It could. That's
but
true.
Potentially,
that's
this could be in a kind of a seedier part of Lake Town. so we saw some structures, but only glimpses, and it looked really nice. But the reason that I think this could be Lake Town is because of what Stephen Fry says in the video interview about what Lake Town looks like and what it feels like and what kind of town it is. And if all goes well, I have it here on the Macintosh.
You can hear that too.
Yeah, so let's go. Let's hope that this video works without any hitches.
Indeed, yes. I've done a whole month in New Zealand in August, which is their winter, oddly enough. And you probably knew that. And we had a fantastic time. I play this character called the Master of Lakeland, who's a very gross figure. And there's a part of Peter Jackson that people might forget who don't know his career, the early career when, you know, Brain Dead and Bad Taste, and he was a gore, schlock gore director of the highest quality and wit. And most of the characters in The Hobbit, you know, are dwarves who are wonderfully funny and active, and Jimmy Nesbitt and Ken Scott and can start in actors like that. There are the silvery elven characters like, you know, Orlando, who of course is so sort of, you know, elegant and beautiful. And there's, you know, Bard the Bowman, who's handsome and strong and all on horses. And obviously there's Ian McKellen, who's wise and marvellous. And my character is an opportunity for sheer grossness. I'm this corrupt mayor, really. I mean, the master of Lake Town, this rather smelly city that's on stilts in the lake below the mountain where Smaug the dragon lives. Or Smaug, actually, as you're supposed to pronounce him. And he had me eating testicles and, you know, sort of gross appetites and a sort of beard. I've got, I mustn't give too much away, but a bald cap, and then on top of that, a really bad comb-over wig, and a wispy moustache and a wispy beard, and horrible blotchy skin, and disgusting fingernails, and really, really, generally speaking, a very unappetizing piece of work, and a coward to boot, and very, very greedy. So, but we had great fun doing it, and the atmosphere on any Peter Jackson set, as any actor will tell you, is wonderful, because he's a kind and a funny and a gentle man, and, you know, for all his extraordinary power and in the business, given the success he's had, he's modest and humble and very easy to work for, and he knows what he wants. And of course, he has the most extraordinary technical backup. The Weta workshop and the Weta digital are these two things in Wellington that he and Richard Taylor have set up that have the best modelling and sculpting and digital facilities in the world, which is why James Cameron went to make Avatar there. He couldn't have made Avatar in Hollywood. They don't have the technical expertise that they do in little old Wellington, the coolest little capital in the world, as they call it. Beautiful city, a lovely place to work. I'm really looking forward. I'm going back in February until May. That's what I'm booked for anyway. So I'll have a long, long period.
So you were right, Dave. This was recorded a while ago, and he's talking about him returning to Wellington and then wrapping up the filming in May. And so I assume that they're a little bit ahead of schedule, and he's done. But what did you think, Dave? You're awfully quiet.
I'm here. Sorry, I had muted myself during the video.
I thought you were just speechless.
Wow, he gives away a lot of information about the characters and stuff, and about, in particular, about his character. I think it's hilarious that he wears a comb-over wig.
Yes, yes, indeed.
I have a feeling his character is going to be really, really ridiculous and smarmy and. I'm really excited to see what he does with that role.
Well, and he talks about all the food that he's eating and how disgusting that was. And I was like, wow, this totally matches the type of stuff that we've seen in the Lord of the Rings movies. Especially, mm-hmm. You know, with the king, what's his name again?
The Lord Denethor.
I mean, there's this scene where he is eating all in a very disgusting way, and even his character kind of sounds a little bit like what Stephen Fry is describing here, except for, you know, different hair. But and then what he said about Lake Town was interesting too. That Lake Town was kind of seedy, run down. I'm thinking almost like a swamp type of town, you know, surrounded by water and everything is a bit dirty and
lots of mosquitoes.
Yeah, and moss and mud and I always imagined Lake Town to be much more glorious, much more, I don't know, more perhaps like something that you would see in the Rohan culture, you know, with wood and more, I don't know, more noble, mm-hmm. but apparently not so. And what did he say about his character? He was kind of greedy and I'm not sure if he said corrupt, but
yeah, I think he did. And that is a good description of that character. He's a very sort of, you know, kind of our worst, all of our worst stereotypes about local officials. Now, I'm sure it's going to play really well in the U.S. That's the U.S. That's generally how we view all politicians. So I'm sure we'll eat it up.
And with this interview in the back of your mind, if you look back at the sneak peek at the Hobbit set and at that house, then I can imagine that this is actually part of Lake Town.
That could be Stephen Fry's house.
Who knows? Could be part, or it could be even part of a bigger structure. And since it's filmed against green screen, and then there's an interesting part of that photo that shows some kind of a chimney that sticks out of the roof. You see that? Or like a big black tube, and there's some red markers on it. So I'm thinking this is probably going to be replaced by computer graphics, or perhaps this is some kind of a ventilation system that they need for, well, dare I say, a fire or a dragon attack, and this thing will go up in flames for some reason, and so that in order to evacuate the smoke, they need that chimney thing. So perhaps this could be part of what we saw on that other photo, which we talked about last time, where you see this smoke coming from something behind a green screen. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is exactly, kind of a more kind of level ground view of what was hidden by the green screens in that previous picture.
Oh, that's a good point. Maybe they're going to burn the house down.
That's what I'm thinking. Or perhaps there are several houses or even an entire city, who knows, and that they were burning it. And that might have been the reason that they had to call in the fire police because something went wrong or, I don't know, something caught fire that wasn't supposed to catch fire. Hopefully it's not Orlando Bloom or, some other actor.
I think maybe that's the mayor's house.
Yeah,
he's such
knows?
A seedy, corrupt guy. That's what kind of place he lives in.
And I'm clicking on the photo, and all of a sudden I see actually a second photo with the fire truck in the foreground and some security personnel. And you can actually tell that on the right side of this house, there is even more. There's a bigger structure. I think this is probably a different house. And there is what looks like a bridge between the two, or some kind of a. I'm not sure if this is a wall or if it's just because it's kind of partially covered by the white trucks there. But do you see what I'm talking about? The second photo.
Oh yeah. It we can't see how they're connected or whether they're connected by that.
It looks like there's a kind of a.
It does look like there's a bridge over the top of that truck, but. That could also just be part of the truck. I can't tell.
It's
starting to look kind of. It looks like a haunted mansion now.
Yeah, indeed, you're right, and it's pretty big. So, I don't know. There's another thing. I don't know if you noticed this, but in the foreground, there is this rail. Structure, and if you look at on the left of the picture, you see this black curtain that is, I think, part of the second green screen, and so they are able to close it if they move it to the right, and it will hang on those rails that we see there.
Oh,
and
you're right. They have a massive curtain on that rail.
It's a huge curtain, and I think if the two are closed, that is exactly what we saw on the photo that we saw last time with the two big green screens.
You're right.
And so I'm thinking, 1 + 1 = 2. This has to be kind of something, a town that that they've set on fire, or where there were fires, in those buildings, and that. Could also be part of, the attack by smog. That's what I'm thinking. But we don't know for sure. It's just speculation, but that's what we do here on the show.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, why don't we take a short break and then move on with our news.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. This is wonderful.
I meant to go back. Wander the paths of Mirkwood. Visit Lake Town. See the Lonely Mountain again. But age, it seems, has finally caught up with me.
This episode is made possible by the friends of SQPN, our loyal supporters and people that help us actually make this podcast and many others that you can find on sqpn.com. When I started this whole podcasting platform, and this is about 6 years ago, I knew that it was going to be a challenge because what I always wanted to do was to make programs that can rival what people hear on radio, on commercial radio, and perhaps even make it better because we can focus actually on niche target audiences, which terrestrial radio normally can't do. And so that's how you can listen to a show like The Secrets of the Hobbit. I mean, normal radio stations would never produce a show like this, but just because there isn't a big enough audience for a weekly show about The Hobbit. But with podcasting, we can do this. And I also knew that in order to sustain this, you need to set this up more like an organization and not just as a something you do in your spare time. And so SQPN has grown into this big platform, and we produce many, many shows every week. We have about a quarter of a million downloads every month, which is huge. And we're entirely supported, completely supported by our listeners. So we don't have any, you know, commercial activity or big checks that we get from anyone. It's every single listener that contributes, either by just moral support, which is huge for us. You know, the encouragements that we get from you as an audience, that's what keeps us going. But then, of course, we also have our server costs and the hosting costs for the podcast. And so we are wrapping up our 2012 giving campaign. And if you are able to support us with either a one-time donation or even on a monthly basis, then you can find all the information on how to do that on the main website of SQPN, which is sqpn.com. But you can also go to our Hobbit page, which you can find at thehobbit.sqpn.com. And, well, if you like what we do and you want to help us out and you want to support us, every donation is welcome, even the small ones. It all helps. And, you know, together we're you know, like one hobbit cannot do much unless you're Bilbo Baggins. But if you've got a lot of hobbits, if you've got 2,000 hobbits, they're a force to be reckoned with. And I figure it's the same thing with our audience. You know, all our listeners together can really make something great happen. And now with the leading up to, you know, the release of the first Hobbit movie, we want to do more. We want to do more ambitious things. We've been talking about all sorts of other great media projects that we could do around The Hobbit, but it all depends on whether we can actually find the funding to do so. So if you want to help out, just go over to sqpn.com and or go to sqpn.com/donate, and you'll be able to find all the information about how to support us. Thanks in advance.
What's happening out there?
Shall I describe it to you? Or would you like me to find you a box?
Well, speaking of finances, in your show notes, I read that New Zealand's film industry is now worth $2.4 billion. And I assume that those are American dollars.
Yep. This is an article from about a week ago. They were just talking about how with the huge increase in feature film activity that's been going on in New Zealand, particularly The Hobbit, the value of production, of the films that are being produced in New Zealand increased over $500 million in 2011. So let's see. The article says the local screen industry contributed $3 billion New Zealand dollars in gross revenues to the New Zealand economy in 2011, an increase of 4% over 2010. It's pretty impressive. It really is kind of becoming a, you know, and Stephen Fry mentioned this in his interview. They're becoming kind of a powerhouse in film production, especially for specific kinds of films. If you need to do a lot of sort of a combination of special effects and outdoors shots, I mean, it's really the place to be now.
And I think it's one huge advantage of New Zealand is that you've got almost every type of landscape. And it's all concentrated on these two relatively small islands. And no matter what you're filming, you can probably find a good backdrop somewhere on either of these two islands. That's very cool. I've never been to Wellington, but I've only been to New Zealand once, and I've been to Auckland, to the capital, and then went to Mata Mata to visit the Hobbit set. But I've never been to this southern island, and I've never been to, well, Wellington is on a northern island, in this, on the kind of the edge of the northern island. But I would be curious to just visit those studios and just see that thriving film industry. And Weta by itself is almost eclipsing Industrial Light and Magic. I wouldn't be surprised if the whole, you know, the movie world is starting to shift, and people will choose to go to New Zealand if it's cheaper, if it's more efficient, and of course that is huge. Hugely beneficial to New Zealand, which has always relied mostly on tourism and on, well, sheep and stuff like that. But with this, they've got an entirely new source of economic wealth, which is tremendous, which is great, and not too many people living there. You know, if I wasn't a priest in the Netherlands, and tied to my diocese, I'd think about it. You know, just moving there. Why not? You know, I can sweep.
I have some friends that have moved there, and they love it.
It is such an amazing country. And it's not just the country, but it's also the people. I just love that kind of laid-back, relaxed, niceness of the New Zealanders. They're very different from Australians, by the way. Australians are awesome, too, but it's a very... To me, as a European, New Zealand feels even more European than Australia. And it's just beautiful combination of the people and really nice cities and then this fantastic landscape, and it's so quiet. I love it. I'd sweep the floors of the studios if I could, of course, perhaps with a hidden camera, but you know, I'd definitely do anything they'd want. Perhaps I should just, you know, go there for the, I don't know, during summertime and just do some freelance work for a couple of weeks. They can miss me here for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll be fine. As long as you promise to record everything and occasionally release a podcast from there.
Well, sure, of course. As long as they've got internet. Although for internet, that's actually a weak link, I think, in the economy of New Zealand. And it's the same in Australia. They pay just enormous sums of money for a little bit of bandwidth. It's incredible because there's just one cable on the ocean floor that goes to the United States. So it's their backbone is very limited. And so there's only like one or two companies there that have a monopoly on everything. And I was just shocked to see how much they pay for their internet. And I think for an industry, a movie industry that is so reliant on digital technology, but also on it's a global economy. So, what Peter Jackson does with the dailies, you know, sending them over to the other side of the country via internet, and then you know they can work even in other parts of the world. This is becoming more and more common. Where if, for instance, an American production company will work in New Zealand, they'll just want to transmit everything digitally to another part of the world, so that when people in New Zealand are sleeping in some other part of the world, they can be working nonstop on whatever post-production process already. And so you need good internet. Although I guess that they might have their special little deal there with the for the Hobbit production.
Yeah, they probably get special treatment, and you know, we always see them setting up whenever they set up one of their little mobile production studio things. They're always the first thing they do are unfolding all their little satellites, which I imagine is they're using for the internet. But satellite has a lot of lag. Although maybe the more modern technologies, especially that a production studio can afford, maybe it's a little better.
Well, I guess for upload, it's not. I'm not sure how that works with satellite connections. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I assume in the middle of nowhere, especially on the southern island, you probably are dependent on satellite connections, because there are no cables there. Perhaps that could be, you know, if the dwarfs would still be around in New Zealand, they'd instead of being in mining, they'd probably be covering the island with cables, because it's much more profitable than mining for gold or diamond.
That's true.
So there is a new biopic of J.R.R. Tolkien's life, but it's a graphic novel. What can you tell us about that?
I want to interrupt you really quick, Father. I found a new piece of breaking news from today.
Uh-oh. Breaking news. Excellent. Yeah,
you got to love the whole Google date time facet tools on the left-hand side. You search for Hobbit, and then you pick only things from the last 24 hours. And I saw a link posted on reddit.com, and I clicked through to it, and it's real. Hobbit Elven Extras casting call on trademe.co.nz posted today.
Oh, cool. Trademe.co.nz.
Yeah, here, I'll give you the link in Skype.
So they need even more more elves.
They need more elves. We're looking for, it says, Elven Extras, here's the next round of casting for The Hobbit. We're looking for Wellington-based men and women, slender builds, 182 centimeters and over, with flexible availability for The Hobbit. Must be 17 years of age or older, will require weekday availability April through mid-July.
That's a long period. Holy moly, that's like 3 months. And could this be for? It seems that they're looking for another large crowd of elves.
Battle.
Yeah, I'm thinking battle too, because we know that they've already done the Rivendell scene, so it can't be for that. They probably already did the Mirkwood scenes as well, at least the ones that take place with the Bilbo's company. So this could be this. Could this be for the final battle? Do you think the five what is it? The Battle of the Five Armies?
Yeah, that's the only thing I can imagine. It must be because we know that they're filming all stuff in the second film right now.
Yeah.
And we know wherever we happen to think the split is, we know that probably most of the scenes in the Elven King's domain have probably been filmed or in the first movie. At least the parts, even if you think that the split will happen a little bit earlier than most people seem to think it does, probably you still any scene where you'd have a crowd of elves has probably already been done. And even then, I imagine most of the scenes in the in Mirkwood and in the Elven King's domain probably aren't going to have huge crowds of elves. So
true.
The only other thing you can imagine is either scenes of the elf army marching toward the Lonely Mountain on their way to besiege the dwarves and get you know reparations and gold, or the actual Battle of Five Armies. So I imagine it's all of that. It's just all the army scenes that take place around the mountain.
And well, there's a remote possibility that this is just for second unit work, and so that they will do pickup shoots of just elves walking around against green screen that they can paste later on in what they've already filmed. But no, I think you're right. This is more. It's more likely that this is part of some kind of a massive scene. It's interesting that they ask for both men and women. Although, of course, we've seen female elves fight as well. And the Battle of Helm's Deep, did that battle have female elves? I don't remember.
You know, they had elves, and I don't think we got really, really close-up glimpses of very many of them other than the Haldir character. And if I recall, they were wearing helmets that had a lot of
true
ornamentation that covered parts of their faces. So, I mean, maybe what they're just looking for is people that have an elvish build, that sort of that lithe, tall, slender but strong kind of build and countenance, and they don't really care whether they're men or women.
Yeah, 182 centimeters. That's pretty tall.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Most of the casting calls they've done before, usually they have different heights for men and women. So it makes me think that maybe they just want people that fit a certain kind of elvish look, and they don't care if they're men and women, and we're not really going to, you know, get close-up looks at a lot of these actors. They just want people that fit a certain look for filling out the army.
Yeah.
Maybe these people will be the basic models they use when they use the computer to multiply the army by, like, a million or whatever it is that they do with it.
Well, and then the mention that they will – need to be to have a flexible availability also indicates that this is probably for scenes without the main actors, because you know, if you're on an on-call basis, it's probably because hey, we've been choreographing this battle and we still need a scene where people are running, you know, from underneath the camera, and we do a sweeping shot, and so could you please come over and all dress up, and we'll give you the ears and you guys just do the same running distance all over and over and over again until we have it, and then we'll call you back next week, you know. Something like that. So interesting. But they will be filming until July, and the weather is not that good. I mean, it's cold. So does Tolkien give any indication about the type, let's say, the weather conditions during the Battle of Five Armies?
I'm sure he does, and it's one of those, this is one of those things where I'm a bad reader and I don't pay that close attention to. Same thing with Lord of the Rings. Like, I have trouble keeping track of sort of the passage of time and seasons and stuff. When does he leave? Boy, I'm really falling down on the job today. I think he leaves in the spring, so I think it's spring or summer when he gets to Lake Town, because I remember them commenting on the fact that it's not winter, I don't think, and yet he's surprised at how desolate the destruction caused by the dragon has left everything. So
Well, if it's just desolate, then I guess it doesn't really matter what type of weather it is.
Yes. Yeah,
and another thing I just thought of is that they are asking for extras in the Wellington area, which means that they are probably going to film all this either on set inside the studio or perhaps on that big outset green screen set. So then it doesn't really matter, because you're just gonna, you know, you're gonna use artificial lighting anyway. So you can if it's against green screen, you can just use lamps to simulate, you know, sunny weather, or you can use wind machines and artificial snow for whatever weather type you need. That actually makes sense. So it's probably, yeah. I'm looking at some pictures of some artwork that was done in the past for the Battle of Five Armies, and it's kind of hard to tell what weather it is. It's not really sunny. It's not really winter. It's kind of in between weather. Lots of dramatic clouds, and just big mayhem. So I have no idea.
Yes. Well, there will be one of the things he does describe is clouds of like carrion type animals flying above the army of the goblins, bats and birds and whatnot. So
cool. Yeah. You. I can imagine that part of this battle will take place either, you know, at night or in the evening, just so you can do even more dramatic lighting, and it's gonna be grim, I think. And Peter Jackson has a tendency in those battle scenes to go for the more the darker look and kind of almost devoid of colors, especially in the two later, the second and the third movie of Lord of the Rings. Most of these battles were kind of just dark and gray and gritty, and there was only this final battle, I think, where we saw a little bit of more of orange colors with the elephants and I'm thinking the ships with the whites on it. I remember some sunlight in those scenes, but we'll see. All right, so that was breaking news. Now back to this this biopic. Is this a comic book based on the life of Tolkien, or what is it?
Yeah, it's basically this company, Blue Water Productions. Their website's bluewaterprod.com. They have a series of graphic novels, basically, you know, extended comic books with really good artwork and more solid covers and bindings. They apparently do a series of biopic graphic novels on various individuals, and the one that they've just recently announced that's coming out in May is for J.R.R. Tolkien. It's called J.R.R. Tolkien, The True Lord of the Rings.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Speaking of J.R.R. Tolkien, I found yet another link to a video, and this was in my Facebook news feed just this morning. And I was like, "Wow, I gotta play some of this on our show because it's quite a cool video. I don't think I can play. Well, I might actually be playing it the entire thing. It's a link to a video that was posted on January the 3rd, but somehow I totally missed it. I think a clip from a BBC production about Tolkien, and it's pretty old stuff. But the cool thing is, it's Tolkien in his own words. So it contains parts of an interview with Tolkien, and it's." For me, you as a Tolkien expert, of course, have heard stuff like this many times. But for me, it was the first time that I actually heard the voice of Tolkien, and that you see him move, and it's just I was like, "Wow, this is awesome!" Let's see if I can play this. It's pretty old. I think it's from the 70s, as far as I can tell. One ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them. This, of course, is not Tolkien. In the land of Mordor, where the
shadows lie. Well, it's a very long story, and it's rather difficult to explain it, but I suppose it all begins when Bilbo finds a magic ring. Well, he doesn't exactly find it. He sort of takes it from Gollum, who lives underground. And then he takes it back to the Shire, where all the hobbits live, because Bilbo's a hobbit.
This is the Hobbit for Dummies.
In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit.
Hobbits were small creatures, about 3 foot high.
4 foot high, curly hair between toes.
And
the sort of person who enjoys 5 meals a day.
I've never seen anything more bourgeois in their life. They seem to spend the whole time sitting around eating meals.
These are students, actually, that are being interviewed about the Hobbit.
Playing all various sort of bar billiards and that sort of thing.
They like leading unadventurous lives, having plenty to eat, and being sure of coming back to their nice warm Hobbit holes and having friends to tea.
They're not a kind of people given to great adventure or to thought.
But some members of the Hobbit race have a strain in them which they don't really like to admit to, which is rather adventurous. And so occasionally, hobbits go out on wild adventures.
It's finally the old basic thing, which must have occurred often in literature, the reluctant hero. And the story, in essence, is the adventures of this little chap. Then, of course, you move out into the wilder world where the imagination can be let go.
That, of course, is the voice of J.R.R. Tolkien. And I never knew that J.R.R. Stands for John
is
Ronald
a world
Royal.
Of myth and magic, as well as a world of strange creatures.
This is very 70s in style.
Sounds like it.
See some fireworks and some eerie music. Let me try to find the part. Oh, here it is. This is where Tolkien himself is talking. It's actually was just about to happen. Let's see.
The actual beginning, though it's not really the beginning, but the actual flashpoint was, I remember very clearly, I could still see the corner in my house in 20 North Moor Road where it happened. I got an enormous pile of exam papers there, and marking school examinations in the summertime is an enormous, very laborious, and unfortunately also boring. And I remember picking up a paper and actually finding, I nearly gave an extra mark for it, extra 5 marks, actually. With one page on this particular paper was left blank. Glorious. Nothing to read, so I scribbled on it, I can't think why. In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. I think that was eventually published in 1937. I now wanted to try my hand at writing a really stupendously long narrative and to see whether I had sufficient art, cunning, or material to make a really long narrative which would hold the average reader right through. The best, one of the best forms for a long narrative is, as was found in The Hobbit, though this is a much more elaborate form, of the pilgrimage on journey with an object. So that was inevitably the form I adopted.
Interesting. So he talks about the Hobbit, how that idea came about, and then he was just looking for a format almost to tell a longer story. This is a ridiculously long story. I love that idea.
Yeah, he discusses this a lot in the prologue that he wrote to The Lord of the Rings. That he wasn't, you know, trying to make money or anything like that, although he certainly had a lot of pressure from the publisher to make something, you know, to make them money, but that he really just wanted to write a long story that he hoped people would enjoy and that he would enjoy writing and that, you know, that told a story he was interested in.
I never thought of the story of the Lord of the Rings as being some kind of a pilgrimage, almost a holy quest. That's a very interesting concept, and in a way, I guess that's exactly it. It's Frodo and Sam on a pilgrimage, and it's a long journey. It's almost like this, you know, the road to Compostela or something like that, with a sacred object, or well, not so sacred. It is a magical object, but it needs to be destroyed, and so it's much more than just an individual journey. It is there's a lot at stake there for the salvation of that particular universe that is Middle Earth. Very cool, and you know, you go on a pilgrimage not only for yourself, but oftentimes for, you know, to the benefit of the people that stay behind or the world that you somehow want to make better. And that's a very, very cool metaphor for the story. Huh. Anyway, you can see this entire clip on the website openculture.com and in the show notes on our own website, thehobbit.sqpn.com. I'll also post a link to it, and I might even embed the entire video. It's a Vimeo video, and it's a bit funky because it's so old, and it reminds me of my younger years when stuff like this was always on television. Almost looks like a parody now, but it's so awesome to just see Tolkien and see how he talks, and he's not a very glamorous person. And he's even a bit, he's verbose, and he's not a very good talker. Quintessential writer, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But fascinating. Do we have interviews with him about The Hobbit?
I don't know. I'm sure there must be plenty. And he talks a lot about both these books in his letters published by Humphrey Carpenter. And so he says a lot about it in there.
Nice.
I don't know if there's audio or video interviews.
I should get those letters because that's a book, right?
Yes,
they've been bundled.
It was compiled into a book and published, and there you can. Yeah, it's easy to get copies. They keep getting reprint all the time.
I also read something, and I didn't really write it down, or I don't have the link ready, but I saw something just the other day. I thought it was also in, either on Twitter or in my Facebook newsfeed, about a new book or documentary about the relationship between Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. So apparently there's a new production. If I can find it, I will talk about it next week in the show.
Cool.
But of course, this was to be expected, that in the kind of the leading up to the movies, you will see lots of new research and new material about the genesis of these stories and Tolkien's background, which I always find fascinating. Even though, you know, it's not autobiographical in any way. It's you know, Tolkien's personal story. It's not like what people did with C.S. Lewis, where you know, like the war, etc., had a direct impact on the storyline. I don't think that with Tolkien that's the case. But still, I want to know the person that just came up with this imaginary world that is so fascinating. It's just amazing. You don't get that many people every generation that can do something like this.
I completely agree. It's a pretty singular achievement.
It is. There was an interview with Peter Lyon from Weta. Is he like the, I don't know, involved in the special effects, or what's his function?
Well, he was at Weta, and he worked on He worked on The Lord of the Rings, and what he does is he's actually a swordsmith.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think, like, I think he's being mum about whether he's doing anything or what he's doing for The Hobbit specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of this this series that the Weta website does, where they interview their various craftsmen and people and ask them what they work on and sort of get a notion of, about their craft. There isn't a whole lot here about The Hobbit or even The Lord of the Rings. Mostly they just talk to him about building weapons for movies and stuff.
Nice. I'm looking at the site. Is that him with the bald head?
Or I believe that is him.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think the craft is just going to be amazing. Just as with The Lord of the Rings, there's, if you have the either the Blu-rays or the extended version on DVD, it's just mind-blowing how much detail went into these movies. And it's only with the advent of Blu-ray and high definition that you're actually able to appreciate the detail, because on DVD it's just not defined enough to see everything. But the swords, the costumes, it just makes this universe so believable.
There is one tidbit. They asked him which sword for Lord of the Rings was the most difficult to make, and he said it was Anduril, just because basically a lot of the detail, the cutouts on the cross and pommel, they're filled with bronze.
Alright.
So that's interesting. It's also his favorite sword he's ever made, though he says it isn't the one he'd wield in a fight.
And we've seen some swords in the trailer for The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. We've seen Sting and some dwarven swords as well.
Yep, I'm really excited to see all the swords and weaponry up close.
I want to have the collector's version to hang on the wall and eventually use it myself from time to time. You never know.
Yeah.
Hey, congratulations to Michael Kaiser from Middle Earth Minutes. They had a new baby. That is so awesome. So there's a new Hobbit.
Yep, that's right.
Amazing. He's got this fantastic Middle Earth Minutes podcast, and he's also heavily involved in the network, right?
Yes, he is. He is the station master. The radio station master.
Fantastic. Hey, also check out the Riddles in the Dark prediction game. You've put out a few episodes, and when we're done with this show, we're going to record another segment for that show. And mm-hmm. How are the predictions? Do you think we're getting close to guessing what the movie will be like?
Yes, I think so. I think we are. I think we're unraveling it, figuring it out.
Nice. Where can people find that show?
Go over to the Mythgard Institute's website, Mythgard, MYTHGARD.org, and then click on exclusives across the tab across the top, and that will give you a drop down menu, and Riddles in the Dark is listed there.
This podcast can be found on the website of the StarQuest Production Network, and the subsite where you can find previous episodes, if you're new to this show, is thehobbit.sqpn.com. Of course, you can also find us on iTunes, and if you're there and you have some time, leave us a review or a 5-star rating. That will help bump up the show in the overall iTunes ratings, and you know, more people will be able to find it. Thank you for listening. Join us this Saturday from 10 a.m. Eastern till 10 p.m. Eastern for our annual SQPN podcast marathon. We'll be doing 12 hours of podcasting to wrap up our giving campaign, and hopefully we will be able to fund another year of podcasting, because I'm not done yet, and we are not done with The Secrets of the Hobbit. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. Follow me on Twitter, Father Roderick, and follow our SQPN Hobbit account as well. It's twitter.com/HobbitPodcast. See you next time on The Secrets of the Hobbit. And until then, God bless.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.